"We have met before, dear," she said in answer to his silent scrutiny, "though you don't seem to be sure of it." "Have you had any dinner, Henry?" his mother asked. There was a reproachful impatience in her voice, as if his hunger were a personal insult to her.
"Yes. No, I wasn't hungry."
"I'd better ring to have them."
"No, mother, not now. It doesn't matter."
"That's the trouble I've always had with you."
She was not looking at him, but reciting words into space.
"It's no use trying to do things for you. You don't appreciate it. I could never make you eat properly."
"Henry, you work too hard," said Philip.
"It's not good for you."
Reardon laughed. "I like it."
"That's what you tell yourself. It's a form of neurosis, you know. When a man drowns himself in work, it's because he's trying to escape from something. You ought to have a hobby."
"Oh, Phil, for Christ's sake," he said,
and regretted the irritation in his voice. Philip had always been in precarious health, though doctors had found no specific defect in his loose, gangling body. He was 38, but his chronic weariness made people think at times that he was older than his brother.
"You ought to learn to have some fun," said Philip. "Otherwise you'll become dull and narrow. Single-tracked, you know. You ought to get out of your little private shell and take a look at the world. You don't want to miss life the way you're doing."
Fighting anger, Reardon told himself that this was Philip's form of solicitude. He told himself that it would be unjust to feel resentment. They were all trying to show their concern for him. And he wished these were not the things they had chosen for concern.
"I had a pretty good time today, Phil," he answered, smiling, and wondered why Philip did not ask him what it was.
He wished one of them would ask him. He was finding it hard to concentrate. The sight of the running metal was still burned into his mind, filling his consciousness, leaving no room for anything else.
"You might have apologized, only I ought to know better than to expect it."
It was his mother's voice. He turned. She was looking at him with that injured look which proclaims the long-bearing patience of the defenseless.
"Mrs. Beecham was here for dinner," she said reproachfully.
"What?"
"Mrs. Beecham. My friend, Mrs. Beecham."
"Yes?"
"I told you about her. I told you many times, but you never remember anything I say. Mrs. Beecham was so anxious to meet you, but she had to leave after dinner. She couldn't wait. Mrs. Beecham is a very busy person. She wanted so much to tell you about the wonderful work we're doing in our parish school, and about the classes in metal craftsmanship, and about the beautiful wrought iron doorknobs that the little slum children are making all by themselves."
It took the whole of his sense of consideration to force himself to answer evenly.
"I'm sorry if I disappointed you, Mother." "You're not sorry. You could have been here if you'd made the effort." "But when did you ever make an effort for anybody but yourself? You're not interested in any of us or in anything we do. You think if you pay the bills, that's enough, don't you? Money, that's all you know. And all you give us is money. Have you ever given us any time?"
If this meant that she missed him, he thought, then it meant affection. And if it meant affection, then he was unjust to experience a heavy, murky feeling, which kept him silent, lest his voice betray that the feeling was disgust.
"You don't care,"
her voice went half spitting, half begging on.
"Lillian needed you today for a very important problem, but I told her it was no use waiting to discuss it with you."
"Oh, Mother, it's not important," said Lillian. "Not to Henry." He turned to her. He stood in the middle of the room with his trench coat still on, as if he were trapped in an unreality that would not become real to him.
"It's not important at all," said Lillian gaily. He could not tell whether her voice was apologetic or boastful. "It's not business. It's purely non-commercial."
"What is it?"
"Just a party I'm planning to give."
"A party?"
"Oh, don't look frightened. It's not for tomorrow night. I know that you're so very busy, but it's for 3 months from now, and I want it to be a very big, very special affair. So would you promise me to be here that night, and not in Minnesota or Colorado or California?"
She was looking at him in an odd manner, speaking too lightly and too purposefully at once, her smile overstressing an air of innocence, and suggesting something like a hidden trump card.
3 months from now," he said. "But you know that I can't tell what urgent business might come up to call me out of town."
"Oh, I know. But couldn't I make a formal appointment with you, way in advance, just like any railroad executive, automobile manufacturer, or junk, scrap dealer? They say you never miss an appointment.
Of course, I'd let you pick the date to suit your convenience. She was looking up at him, her glance acquiring some special quality of feminine appeal by being sent from under her lowered forehead up toward his full height. She asked, a little too casually and too cautiously, "The date I had in mind was December 10th. But would you prefer the 9th or the 11th?
"It makes no difference to me," she said gently.
"December 10th is our wedding anniversary, Henry."
They were all watching his face. If they expected a look of guilt, what they saw instead was a faint smile of amusement. She could not have intended this as a trap, he thought, because he could escape it so easily by refusing to accept any blame for his forgetfulness and by leaving her spurned. He knew that his feeling for her was her only weapon. Her motive, he thought, was a proudly indirect attempt to test his feeling and to confess her own. A party was not his form of celebration, but it was hers. It meant nothing in his terms. In hers, it meant the best tribute she could offer to him and to their marriage. He had to respect her intention, he thought, even if he did not share her standards, even if he did not know whether he still cared for any tribute from her. He had to let her win, he thought, because she had thrown herself upon his mercy. He smiled an open, unresentful smile in acknowledgment of her victory. "All right, Lillian," he said quietly. "I promise to be here on the night of December 10th.
"Thank you, dear."
Her smile had a closed, mysterious quality. He wondered why he had a moment's impression that his attitude had disappointed them all. If she trusted him, he thought, if her feeling for him was still alive, then he would match her trust. He had to say it. Words were a lens to focus one's mind, and he could not use words for anything else tonight. "I'm sorry I'm late, Lillian, but today at the mills, we poured the first heat of Reardon metal." There was a moment of silence. Then Philip said, "Well, that's nice." The other said nothing. He put his hand in his pocket. When he touched it, the reality of the bracelet swept out everything else. He felt as he had felt when the liquid metal had poured through space before him. "I brought you a present, Lillian." He did not know that he stood straight, and that the gesture of his arm was that of a returning crusader offering his trophy to his love, when he dropped a small chain of metal into her lap. Lillian Reardon picked it up, hooked on the tips of two straight fingers, and raised it to the light. The links were heavy, crudely made. The shining metal had an odd tinge. It was greenish-blue. "What's that?" she asked. "The first thing made from the first heat of the first order of Reardon metal."
"You mean," she said, "it's fully as valuable as a piece of railroad rails?"
He looked at her blankly. She jingled the bracelet, making it sparkle under the light.
"Henry, it's perfectly wonderful. What originality. I shall be the sensation of New York, wearing jewelry made of the same stuff as bridge girders, truck motors, kitchen stoves, typewriters, and, what was it you were saying about it the other day, darling? Soup kettles."
"God, Henry, but you're conceited," said Philip. Lillian laughed.
"He's a sentimentalist, all men are. But, darling, I do appreciate it. It isn't the gift. It's the intention, I know."
"The intention's plain selfishness, if you ask me," said Reardon's mother. "Another man would bring a diamond bracelet if he wanted to give his wife a present, because it's her pleasure he'd think of, not his own. But Henry thinks that just because he's made a new kind of tin, why, it's got to be more precious than diamonds to everybody, just because it's he that's made it. That's the way he's been since he was 5 years old, the most conceited brat you ever saw. And I knew he'd grow up to be the most selfish creature on God's earth."
"No, it's sweet," said Lillian. "It's charming."
She dropped the bracelet down on the table. She got up, put her hands on Reardon's shoulders, and raising herself on tiptoe, kissed him on the cheek, saying,
"Thank you, dear."
He did not move, did not bend his head down to her. After a while, he turned, took off his coat, and sat down by the fire apart from the others. He felt nothing but an immense exhaustion. He did not listen to their talk. He heard dimly that Lillian was arguing, defending him against his mother.
I know him better than you do, his mother was saying. Hank Reardon's not interested in man, beast, or weed unless it's tied in some way to himself and his work. That's all he cares about. I've tried my best to teach him some humility. I've tried all my life, but I failed.